it was like sitting there and watching my own funeral. The mental image that I could be dead and this could be real.
In 2009, a photo of a woman murdered by the Iranian regime became a symbol of revolution. Trouble was, it was the wrong photo. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In Britain, the government wants to create an independent regulator to oversee a seemingly ungovernable press.
Obviously, over the past 200 years, the media have been drinking in the last chance saloon of self-regulation.
Also, what's life like at home when your dad's the man behind the infamous Hollywood communist blacklist?
Growing up, there was a gun in every drawer. My father slept with a revolver by his bed.
All that and more coming up next.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the summer of 2009, a wave of protests broke out in the streets of Iran.
Thousands of young opposition protesters spilled out onto the streets in a spontaneous outburst of anger against what they said was a rigged election.
Dictatorship. They were shouting, Mousavi, get my vote back for me.
Nothing has been seen on the streets of Tehran like this since the revolution, right back in 1979.
During one of those protests, a 26-year-old woman named Neda Aga Sultan was killed after being shot in the chest. A tragedy captured on cell phone video.
Posted to YouTube and other internet sites, the first shocking snippet of cell phone video ran less than a minute, with voices shouting, Neda has been shot. Neda, don't be scared. Then, Neda, stay alive.
One woman slain in front of the world has become the face of an entire movement.
Time magazine called it probably the most widely witnessed death in human history. Protesters across the globe held posters of her image, vowing her death would not be in vain. But on many of those posters and in countless news reports, it wasn't her face on display. It was the face of another young Iranian, a woman named Neda Sultani, who was very much alive. That Neda was working at a university in Iran when her photo was lifted from her Facebook page and mistakenly used to put a face to the fallen protester. Now living in exile, she says that at the time of the 2009 demonstrations, she wasn't even a political activist.
I did not even vote in that election.
When did you become aware of the death of the other Neda?
The morning after she was shot to death, I had almost 300 Facebook friendship invitations from all over the world. What I did not know at that point was that I had already been mistaken with her. I started receiving phone calls from friends, students, colleagues, all of whom kept telling me they had seen me on this TV broadcast, on that TV broadcast, and who broke down on the phone once they heard my voice because they had prepared themselves to call and hear that I had been killed.
They were seeing you on Iranian channels, Fox News, CNN.
Exactly.
Were they seeing you?
It was my face, the Facebook photo that had been taken from my profile without my knowledge. And of course, at the beginning, it was my name as well. So they were calling the real victim, who is Neda Aga Sultan, with my name, Neda Sultani, and they were using my photo to be the face of opposition.
The names are similar, but they are not the same. How did media outlets around the world mistakenly use your image?
I once did an interview with a French newspaper, and the journalist told me that the media has turned into a huge mechanism that once it gets started, it is impossible to stop. And of course, that video shows something so tragic, and the experience of that is so profound. Everybody just rushed to give a face to that poor woman who had such a tragic death, and nobody second-checked the source. Within minutes, my photo was everywhere.
These images of you weren't just used in the media. Demonstrators began to use your picture during the protests. Alongside the graphic images of the deceased Neda, they held your picture with the words, "Neda did not die in vain."
Exactly.
What was that like, seeing your face in candlelight vigils?
It was like watching my own funeral. The mental image that I could be dead. That was a very, very terrifying experience. On the other hand, it was very shocking because I could not believe my face would wrongly go all over the world as the symbol of opposition, which I was not.
You were just the quiet scholar of English literature.
That was the life that I had.
What did you do?
Together with several people, we started writing emails, blogs, made phone calls, talked to TV producers. Nobody listened to us. So even after the family of the deceased, Neda, provided several photos of her, the international media kept using my photo.
Tell me about some of your experiences to try to get this fixed.
Two different people contacted two different producers from CNN and talked to them in length about the mistake. The reaction we received was that CNN kept broadcasting my photo. In a more disheartening example, when I sent a second photo of mine to Voice of America Farsi channel, and I asked them to compare the photo to see that I was not fabricating the story, to my terror and shock, the next evening, I saw that they broadcasted the second photo as an exclusive photo of the deceased Neda.
Did they explain?
Nothing. Nobody ever wrote back. Nobody ever apologized.
So here you are, trying to correct this. How did people respond, besides ignoring you?
We started receiving hate mails for distorting the face of a true hero. People were arguing that I was an agent of the Islamic Republic, that the photo did not belong to me. They had seen it everywhere on the media. Of course, they would believe the media. People started calling me a whore, a bitch, a slut, whatever you can imagine. It really killed me mentally and emotionally. And then my situation got dangerous once the Iranian Secret Service realized that there has been a mistake. They came for me and they started trying to use what has happened to me to their own advantage.
What did they want from you?
That video has been one of the largest scale scandals for the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the Iranian regime had desperately been trying to wash their hands off the blood of that innocent woman. They wanted to use my story to claim that that video is Western propaganda, the conspiracy against the Islamic Republic of Iran by the Western media, and that that poor innocent woman had not been killed in the first place. That, look, people, this is the photo you have seen, and this is the person who owns the photo. The whole thing is fake. I did not cooperate, and they charged me with treason against the national security of my country, which in Iran can bring about death penalty. And I remember that one of those agents told me that, look, when it comes to the national security of our Islamic fatherland, you and your fate as an individual does not count. I had friends who started telling me that I needed a backup plan in case things go wrong, and they arranged for my escape. The whole sequence of events happened in a matter of 12 days from the day she was shot to death to the day I left Iran.
You know, just last year, there were photos of a London woman by the name of Yelena Lechich, who was used on the Gay Girl in Damascus site. Actually, it was an American man in Scotland who did a kind of creative writing project and just took this photo and created this Gay Girl in Damascus blog. The media eventually caught on, but not before her image had been used all around the world. Is there any way that this can be avoided?
Social networks are an indispensable part of modern life. So you cannot get life to a pre-social networking era anymore. But what always surprises me is how carelessly and how recklessly the data that comes out of these social networking systems like Facebook, like Twitter, are being used by very, very professional journalists. There are such times that you start doubting media in general.
You think? So is the Iranian government even today still insisting that the death of Nehra was just propaganda from the West?
Yes, they do. In one of their recent reactions, they claimed that Nehra Agha Sultan was alive and she was living in Germany, which is me.
Do you think you'll ever go back?
I'm very hopeful.
What did you leave behind?
I left behind my family. I left behind my friends. I left behind my job. I left behind my world. You do not like to live a life in a shadow. And that is somehow my life. I have to live the rest of my life in the shadow of a person that I am not.
Do you think about her much?
She's a part of me. I go through life with her.
What does that feel like?
Sad. Not for myself, but for her. Because life is a blessing. And I so wholeheartedly wish that this second chance that has been granted me to build up a new life from scratch, no matter how uncertain it is, I wholeheartedly wish that it had been granted her as well.
Thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Nehra Sultani is a visiting scholar at Montclair State University and author of My Stolen Face, The Story of a Dramatic Mistake.
Coming up, 70 years ago, The Hollywood Reporter started naming the names of supposed communists in the film industry.
70 years later, they'd like you to know that they're really, really sorry. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This Thursday, Britain's Leveson Inquiry released its report on the practices and ethics of the British press. Impaneled in the wake of the News of the World voicemail hacking scandal that has led to criminal charges against a number of top former News Corp executives, the Parliamentary Commission recommends the creation of an independent regulatory body to, quote, promote high standards of journalism and protect both the public interest and the rights of individuals. The report contends that the British press has proven itself incompetent at policing itself. One Conservative Party politician leading that charge is a Member of Parliament, Nadeem Zahawi. Mr. Zahawi, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, you have a unique perspective on this question because you grow up in Iraq and you wrote about that as having influenced your thinking.
That's exactly right. My instinct was against any form of political interference because I came to the UK when I was 7 years old, my parents fleeing the murderous regime of Saddam Hussein, their only crime was being Kurdish and not willing to belong to the Baath Party. I knew what a country was like where a dictator was able to control the media, and I do not want our country to go back to the 17th century and license the media. I want them to be free. And so, honestly, I'm not going into this because I think that it's a better way of governing if we had a docile, cooperative media that did what it's told by politicians.
Saddam was obviously a brutal dictator, but he ruled by laws passed by a rubber stamp parliament. Isn't a press law of any kind a tool that just invites political abuse?
It could if the law requires parliament to regulate. You need a truly independent regulator, which is what Lord Justice Leveson has recommended in his report, but underpinned in statute. And we have examples of this in the UK. So our judiciary is independent of politicians and government, but its provenance is based on statute. The same for the Advertising Standards Authority that regulates advertising in the UK. And so I think you need that because, obviously, over the past 200 years, the media have been drinking in the last chance saloon of self-regulation. There's been so much rule-breaking, as Lord Justice Leveson found out. Millie Dowler, who was a teenager who was murdered, her phone was hacked so that her parents thought that she was still alive. The McCanns, who lost their daughter, where the mother's diary was published without her consent. We're not talking about the wealthy and the powerful. They can look after themselves through the libel laws and defamation laws. What we're talking about is protection for ordinary people.
But what would a press law do to help the Dowler family and the McCanns that existing criminal statutes about phone hacking, about theft, obstruction of justice, aren't doing right now?
Well, two things. An arbitration process that is swift and affordable for ordinary people. There was another case, by the way, Chris Jeffries, accused wrongly of murdering a tenant in his home. He was mauled by the press before anyone stopped to think, actually, maybe he's not the culprit. So you need an arbitration process so that we can get these things resolved very quickly with the right reprimand, whether financial or an apology on the front page, as prominent as the initial story. And the other thing that you need is what we term the Richard Desmond problem. One of the proprietors in the UK, Mr. Desmond, refused to sign up to the self-regulator. There was no reprimand. Now, what Leveson is recommending is if they don't sign up to the new independent regulator, then the courts can take that into consideration if they are then found to have done something wrong.
It seems to me that once you have the government statute underpinning any kind of regulatory apparatus, that there will be a chilling effect on reporting that you get from an independent press. How do you make sure that you're not throwing out the baby of press freedom with the bathwater?
One of the things that the new independent regulator will need to do is make sure that there is a standard for public interest. Now, the broadcasters are already regulated, whether it's the BBC with its board or ITV with Ofcom. Let's not forget, ITV broke one of the most important stories in the UK. Jimmy Savile, who was a big star in the UK in the 70s and 80s, turned out after his death to be a paedophile. ITV broke that story, although they are regulated. One of the things we looked at is you could have a standard for public interest, which allows newspapers like The Telegraph to break the law and to pay for the CD that had the MP's expenses on it because they were exposing wrongdoing by politicians. And for that same reason, I'd be happy for any press outlet to have hacked Jimmy Savile if they had the evidence that he was a paedophile. If you have a clear standard for public interest, you will create a media that is more aggressive and investigative. The way you do it is not by effectively allowing them to mark their own homework, as Leveson put it. You need to have a truly independent regulator, independent of politicians and independent of the media themselves.
The internet has become a major source of news and almost news. In time, it may be the only channel. So is this whole argument moot?
One of the ideas that we looked at was some sort of a voluntary kite mark that could be part of the new independent regulator. If bloggers and news sites are able to demonstrate to the regulator that they want to be part of this, then the reader of those blogs can see that that blog does follow the regulator's guidelines on good journalism. There isn't a good answer to how you do this. This is probably the most compelling argument anyone can make against Lord Leveson's proposals. But you need, I think, to at least have a go.
Mr. Zahawi, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Nadeem Zahawi is a member of Parliament representing Stratford-on-Avon.
November 25th was the 65th anniversary of the first Hollywood blacklist. The list included the names of the so-called Hollywood Ten, screenwriters cited for contempt when they refused to answer questions before the House Un-American Activities Committee about their alleged ties to the Communist Party. The blacklist was headline news in the early 50s when Senator Joseph McCarthy rode to fame on a wave of fear. Now, a feature in last week's Hollywood Reporter recounts how its founder and publisher, William R. Wilkerson, was instrumental in launching the blacklist era. Hollywood Reporter writers Daniel Miller and Gary Baum penned the piece. Daniel, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks so much for having me.
So who was Billy Wilkerson?
He was the owner, founder, editor, and publisher of The Hollywood Reporter, which he started in 1930. But he was more than just a newspaper man. He also owned nightclubs. He built the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas. And he mixed it up with the A-list stars of the day. He was really a force to be reckoned with.
What was his role in instigating the blacklist?
Shortly after the end of World War II, Billy began penning columns. His column was called Trade Views, and it came out every day on the cover of The Hollywood Reporter. And these columns were anti-communist. There was a lurking red beachhead, as he called it. Billy began naming names in 1946, and many of the names that he named were people who wound up being blacklisted.
Among the people he listed that wound up on the Hollywood 10 list, Spartacus screenwriter Dalton Trumbo and Casablanca co-writer Howard Koch.
Trumbo and Koch were among the more prominent screenwriters that Wilkerson named early on. Many of the people that he named were just getting their start in Hollywood. Once Joseph McCarthy was presiding over his reign of terror, I guess you could call it, he once called Billy and asked him for advice on how he went about gathering up names. So Billy was an influential guy.
There are many conflicting theories as to what made him such a vociferous anti-communist.
Billy Wilkerson's son, Willie Wilkerson, believes that his father was trying to get revenge on the studio heads who had stymied him in the 1920s when he had attempted to start a movie studio. So basically, Willie believes that his father was holding a grudge for decades and in the late 1940s saw this as an opportunity to hurt the movie heads. Willie told me when I interviewed him that there were two topics that he was not allowed to ask his father about. And this was the mob. Billy Wilkerson is known to have connections to the mafia. And communism. So this was not something that Willie appears to have learned directly from his father. The view that I have, along with my co-writer, Gary Baum, is perhaps a bit more nuanced. We view Billy Wilkerson as a businessman first and foremost. The Hollywood Reporter was dependent on the movie studios to buy ads. And in that respect, we see Billy as somebody who was actually in lockstep with the studio heads, who were also anti-communist.
You suggest that who he really wanted to go to war with was the Screenwriters Guild. You cite an editorial from the 1930s in which Wilkerson asks of the Screenwriters Guild, quote, "What has this great industry done to all of you that you must go into frenzies about the injustice that is done to you, pack into meetings with speech-making, arm-waving, searching for the power to kill the very business that has made many of you rich?"
That's right. He felt that organized screenwriters could usurp some of the control that the studios had.
Talk to me about his mob connections. I read that he palled around with bosses like Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel. Did that contribute to his anti-communist stance?
This goes back to long-held beliefs by organized crime that put them in opposition to organized labor. Wilkerson was closely aligned with mob players like Siegel. In fact, they built the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas together. That relationship soured, ultimately leading Billy Wilkerson to flee to Paris, where he holed up in the George V Hotel out of fear that Bugsy was going to kill him. But at the end of the day, the through line is business. So if the mafia heads are telling him unions are bad for business, that rubs off on Billy. If he hears something similar from the studio heads, again, it rubs off on Billy, and I think it really shaped his worldview.
Why is The Hollywood Reporter telling this story on the 65th anniversary of The Blacklist? Why didn't you do it on the 50th anniversary of The Blacklist?
The Hollywood Reporter changed hands recently, and that has really given us a clean break with the past and an opportunity to look back and assess our past. This was something that The Hollywood Reporter had never done before, though that wasn't for a lack of trying, at least on the part of one reporter who in 1997 attempted a story that perhaps would have looked much like what I wrote with Gary.
On the 50th anniversary.
That's right. Reporter Dave Robb of The Hollywood Reporter wrote a lengthy piece about THR's role in the Blacklist era, and his editor read it over and effectively said, this is a great story, but we can't publish it. The era was just too painful to revisit.
What was the part of the story you felt queasiest about?
I certainly was no Blacklist expert, and one of the ways I got to familiarize myself was basically by reading back issues. I was stunned by some of the bold headlines on the front page of The Hollywood Reporter, phrases like commies and reds in big splashy headlines. How Wilkerson used the publication for his own agenda, it was surprising just how visceral some of his attacks were.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Daniel Miller, along with his colleague Gary Baum, wrote a feature about The Hollywood Reporter's role in the communist blacklist. As we heard, in the course of that work, Miller contacted Billy Wilkerson's son, Willie Wilkerson, who ended up writing an apology for his father's red-baiting for the magazine. Willie says he's wanted to publicly apologize for 15 years, even though he wasn't even born when his father began his anti-communist crusade. Willie says he's been in the shadow of the Blacklist his entire life.
I am the victim of what is known as reverse blacklisting. The people that my father named went on to have children, who then went into the entertainment industry, who then wouldn't give me employment. So by issuing an apology, it hopefully levels the playing field and stops this terrible anger.
You wrote in your apology, quote, "The movie brass refused him entry into their club and squashed his dream, so he found another dream, exacting revenge."
I mean, this is a classic revenge story that rivals The Count of Monte Cristo. In 1927, he wanted to start his own film studio as an independent. The problem was is that the movie moguls at that time, they owned the talent, they owned the distribution, they owned the theater chains. So it would have been very difficult for my father as an independent to produce something and to get it distributed to their movie chains without them inviting him into his club. Now, we don't know the reason why they rejected him, but he took that rejection very personally because he realized then that he could not have the dream that he wanted to, which was to build his own studio. So he started The Reporter in 1930, and he would get his gangster friends to guard his reporters as they broke into studio executive offices in the middle of the night to steal sensitive material so that he could publish it front page.
Willie, do you have any proof of these accusations?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is part of the public record. It's been written about.
Now, you were 11 when your father died.
That's correct.
Did he talk about the Blacklist? Did he talk about communism?
No, this was one of the forbidden subjects at the dinner table. Mm-hmm. And of course, being a kid, it just piqued my curiosity even more. I mean, after his death in 1962, I read Das Kapital by, you know, Marx and Hegel, because I wanted to find out what this forbidden subject was. Growing up, there was a gun in every drawer. My father slept with a revolver by his bed. He drove armor-plated cars. My mother and my father got into these screaming matches at the dinner table. My mother demanded that we as a family be relocated to Europe because there were ongoing death threats against my family.
From whom?
We don't know. We can only presume from the people that my father maligned.
You mean like Dalton Trumbo is going to slap your father with a death threat?
You know, there would be anonymous phone calls calling the house, apparently, that my mother told me about. Obviously, I mean, this really rattled my mother. She wanted to be relocated with my sister and myself, and my father be left in Hollywood to fight his own battles.
This apology you wrote on behalf of your entire family, you kept from your family. Was it because you didn't think your family would be on board? Did you think that you had a right to speak for all of them without letting them know?
This came very quickly, and I just sort of made an executive decision standing on my feet. I suppose if I had gone to, you know, my sister or my son or my cousin Ron Wilkerson and had a chance to mull this over, I mean, they probably would have maybe talked me out of it. So I said, look, I've been meaning to do this for 15 years. I've got to go ahead and do this.
In spite of all of this, you call your father a great man.
There's also an element in this karmic aspect where the truth will set you free. I feel obligated as his biographer to tell the true story of his life. I mean, 80% of it is just absolutely remarkable, the things he achieved, the people that he helped. I mean, he discovered more movie stars independently outside of the movie system than any other individual. But there was that 20% which makes me cringe.
Willie, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Willie Wilkerson is the son of Hollywood Reporter founder Billy Wilkerson.
Coming up, the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act has been signed into law.
Start popping those corks. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week in Burma, or Myanmar, the seizure of land for a government-owned copper mine once again brought protesters out into the streets, who were routed by the police. Myanmar certainly is no stranger to protests and a brutal government response, but this week's episode was notable for two reasons. It's been mere months since the country made protests legal, and the police response is seen as a gauge of just how government reforms will be respected. The demonstrations also come in the same month Barack Obama became the first serving U.S. president to visit Myanmar, a Southeast Asian nation once uttered in the same breath as North Korea. And his presence was a striking acknowledgement of just how substantial Myanmar's democratic changes have been. In an impassioned speech, he acknowledged both the astonishing reforms implemented in the past 2 years and the long road ahead. Reporter Gabriel Pollack was in the newsroom of the Myanmar Times in downtown Rangoon, or Yangon, when he delivered it.
I stand here with confidence that something is happening in this government.
Reporters crowded around the TV and laughed when Obama ended his speech with a slow and cautious thank you.
So,
just a year ago, this scene would have been unthinkable. The United States didn't have formal diplomatic ties with Myanmar. But in August, President Thein Sein's reform government finally kept its promise to end censorship. Before last August, the Myanmar Times would send proofs to the press scrutiny board where government officials decided what was fit to print. Jeffrey Goddard edited the English language edition for 7 years.
Some censorship decisions have appalled me, some have astonished me, most have disappointed me, but, you know, that is the system and I had to accept it.
he recalls an incident earlier this year when Myanmar's chief censor, Tin Sway, was interviewed about the imminent end of censorship.
It was a story about the end of censorship, and Tin Sway censored it. And what made it kind of personal for me is that one of the paragraphs he censored from the story was a quote I had given anonymously to Agence France-Presse, in which I said, quote, "He had one of the worst jobs in Myanmar. He was pressured from above by ministers, officials and powerful business people to keep stories out, and pressured from below by editors to keep stories in. And he cut it out of the story," which I think is pretty funny.
Not having censorship is very good for development of Burmese literature and for the country also.
Tin Sway was Myanmar's last chief censor. He started out in the army as editor for a military science magazine and was eventually promoted to the Information Ministry, where he became chief of the Press Scrutiny Board, or PSRD. When the government declared an end to censorship, he reflected on his time as a censor in an article called Literary Torturer.
My present office was the office of the Japanese secret police during the Second World War. That was where they took people they arrested for interrogation and torture. It is well known as the ruthless Japanese secret police center. And when building was changed into the PSRD office, people said this office was no longer a place to torture people. Instead, it became a place to torture the media, literature, by cutting, blocking and omitting ideas, opinions and thought. That's why they nicknamed me Literary Torturer.
The former secret police headquarters is grim, dilapidated, filled with stacks of moldy documents, slowly losing a battle against the encroaching rain-soaked jungle. It was a place where hopes and dreams were shattered.
You know, for all my friends who are writers here, it was a place of trauma. You know, they would come here and they would leave just traumatized.
Amitav Ghosh, Bengali author of The Glass Palace, has stopped by the building with Burmese author Mathita to pay a friendly visit.
I remember being told a story by a modernist writer who would come here, and she would be interrogated by some young lieutenant or something, who would then roll up her things and throw it in the corner and hit it with a golf club. And it was, I mean, you know, the fact that it sounds funny to us just goes to show, in a way, you know, how far Burma has moved, you know.
Many believe the building is haunted by the souls of prisoners that were tortured there. But Mathita, who just published a memoir of her imprisonment for threatening national serenity, is haunted by the souls of lost stories.
You know, it took me to get permission for my first and only novel in Burmese. It took altogether more than 8 months, and then I was arrested. So they asked the printer to stop. So this, the first and only novel, it took me altogether 10 years to get published, including my imprisonment time, you could imagine. So it's kind of haunting, you know, haunting for us.
Former censor Tin Sway also describes being haunted.
It is my job to decide what should be published and what shouldn't be published. I question myself and my intellect that my brain wasn't good enough to make the right decision. I wanted to make only the most necessary cut, but sometimes I did cut off more than I should have. But it was because I was simply afraid of repercussion, or the writing was unclear to me.
His old office is now an ordinary registry for books, magazines, even songs. But transformation is tricky. The abolition of censorship is just one of many steps the government is taking to dismantle a military bureaucracy once so pervasive the nation can barely function without it. Extracting it is like trying to remove a person's skeleton without killing it. Musician and radio DJ Jeb Bulk says he finds his creativity is challenged by the new freedom.
Just think about it. You're in the cage, right? You're a bird and you're in the cage. You haven't fly for like all your life, and then you just open the gate and you don't know what to do now. So we're free now. Okay, well, we don't have to go for the sensible, but how far we can push? That's the important thing. But we don't know the limit.
The new generation is testing the limits. Arrests of copper mine protesters this past week in Yangon illustrates just how perilous the end of censorship can be in a state with such a hobbled system of justice. Once the Burmese people were silenced systematically by the state, personified by Tin Tsui and his red pen, now they have free speech, in theory, but not always in reality. Meanwhile, Tin Tsui has started posting his own short nonfiction on his Facebook page.
Tin Tsui plans to write a memoir of his life as a censor.
Censors, after all, were censored too.
For On the Media, I'm Gabrielle Paluch in Yangon, Myanmar.
Now I have to move aside, feeling like I'm left behind. Well, I do have another confession. No one's perfect and I'm just no one. Sure, I call myself the perfect man.
In late 2010, the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, which had overwhelming bipartisan support, was killed just before the end of the congressional session by a secret hold, a procedure that allows a single senator to anonymously stop a bill from reaching the floor. This seemed to us a most undemocratic way to kill a crucial piece of legislation to protect government whistleblowers. So we launched the Blow the Whistle Project, asking our listeners to call their senators to ask if they had torpedoed the Whistleblower Act. After hundreds of calls by OTM listeners, we narrowed down the search to just two senators, both of whom refused to comment. Well, in the almost 2 years since we launched that project, the secret hold was reformed. The Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act was reintroduced in Congress, and on Tuesday, it was signed into law. Tom Devine, legal director of the Government Accountability Project, inspired and worked with us on Blow the Whistle, and he says the act, a long time in coming, has real power to change the life of a government whistleblower.
The main thing that it does is overturns 18 years of hostile court decisions in which precedents were set, giving whistleblowers a track record of 3 wins and 226 defeats. It also protects government scientists who challenge censorship. It gives free speech rights to the 40,000 baggage screeners at the airports. It gives employees normal access to appeals courts, so they're not at the mercy of this court that's ruled against them 226 out of 229 cases. It gives them compensatory damages, so when they win, they actually can really win.
Can you give me some poster child type examples of whistleblowers who suffered before the passage of this law who now would be protected by it?
Well, let's do a list of poster children. They expose prescription drugs that kill the patients. They expose cover-ups of air safety violations that cause unnecessary crashes and blanket domestic surveillance of all Americans' electronic communications. They made warnings that if they had been heeded, could have prevented the 9/11 hijacking. They exposed government plans to abandon air marshal coverage during a confirmed 9/11 rerun in 2003, or there's what they did in Iraq. They exposed an 18-month failure to deliver mine-resistant armored vehicles, which was the cause for one-third of corresponding casualties and led to their deliveries. The whistleblower on that, Franz Geil, was on your program. They exposed how our own government has been arming Mexican drug cartels, who then use the weapons we supplied to kill our agents. They've exposed the full causes and scope of the threat to society from climate change. I could keep going on for a long time, Bob.
Well, no, you're doing very well. What was stripped from the bill that you had hoped it would include?
The good news is that federal whistleblowers have the strongest rights in their history. The bad news is that there were some key Republican gatekeepers, primarily in the House of Representatives, who blocked two of the cornerstones for this reform. One is jury trials to enforce these free speech rights. The second thing that was stripped out was free speech rights for intelligence community employees, like those at the CIA or at the NSA who exposed domestic surveillance, for example. That's where we've got the worst indefensible spending, because it's the most secret part of our government. And it's the highest stakes, too. Those people could be the most significant whistleblowers in the federal workforce. In the House Permanent Select Intelligence Committee said they'd kill the whole bill if we included rights for those people.
The administration, realizing that these provisions had been stripped out, actually acted in a way that arguably is against the interests of their own power base. Explain how they did that.
In a presidential policy directive, President Obama had restored the lion's share of national security rights that the House had removed. And it's really only fair to give credit where it's due here. This is the first time in history that a president unilaterally has made it easier for his employees to challenge his own administration's actions.
What's most amazing about it is that the very Obama White House that became your champion was the most aggressive administration in memory in prosecuting whistleblowers. There's a little cognitive dissonance there.
Well, there's a clear explanation to reconcile that contradiction. The administration has been going after people who made public disclosures of information. The whistleblower directive that the president issued gives free speech rights for those working within institutional checks and balances. It means that when they are the messengers who warn their bosses that we're about to step in it, the boss no longer has the legal option to silence that person.
Okay, Tom, so high fives all around. And I guess those high fives should include On the Media's own listeners who rallied behind our call for action and actually embarrassed the Senate into rethinking its secret holds.
Well, we didn't have to wait for reforms in the Senate on secret holds to find out who is behind sabotaging the whistleblower protection law in 2010. On the Media's listeners did it for us. They called up their Senate offices around the country and grilled them. And as the offices who put the holds on it told us, we're not going to do this again. And they didn't. So I think you folks deserve a whole lot of credit for making a difference. But it's not just On the Media. It's the whistleblowers who risked their careers and then allowed us to tell their stories. And what's really inspiring for me is how much bipartisan work was behind this. The staff of Representative Darrell Izzo'd give them all public service medals for how hard they worked to get that bill through the House before Congress adjourned this time. And then we have a president who, instead of just giving public lip service while trying to undercut the reforms behind closed doors, fought for more teeth in the whistleblower bill.
Tom, all props to the president, but as I understand the directive, he is allowing the agencies themselves, let's say the CIA and the National Security Agency, to write their own guidelines, which makes me wonder if the fox is guarding the hen house. And I gather the directive is only good for the duration of the president's term in office and could be turned upside down by a subsequent administration.
Both of your concerns are well taken. And so we're going to have our hands full over the next 9 months, the time frame to issue regulations, to convince these agencies to issue credible due process that's not setting up a new kangaroo court system. And that's going to be a tough sell, because these are the agencies that normally would be the defendants in a real lawsuit. The Presidential Policy Directive also is only the law until some president changes his or her mind. The next president could remove it on day one, just like Mr. Romney was going to do with Obamacare. So we need to get Congress to make these rights permanent.
What's your next target?
Making sure that these rights take root and stick. And over the next 2 years, built into this law, there's going to be a study on whether enforcement should be expanded to give federal workers jury trials when they're retaliated against. And a key part of this law was normal access to the appeals court, so they're not at the mercy of this one that rubber stamps anything the government does. And that's a 2-year experiment. And we're going to have to work our heads off to make sure that these reforms take root and it's not just another mirage.
All right. Now, Tom, I have to ask you one more thing. One of the reasons whistleblowers have fared so poorly is this string of lower court and appellate decisions that have worked against them for decades, all of which creates a lot of legal precedent, which courts tend to defer to. Is there going to be some sort of judicial showdown between the precedent that has long since been established against the interests of whistleblowers and this new law?
The courts created all these loopholes through interpretations of statutory language. They're going beyond their boundaries when they do that. Well, the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act specifically, literally overturns every one of the hostile precedents behind those 226 defeats. They'll have to switch to another language in the court system if they're going to repeat these outrages. However, we've got a lot of work over the next 2 years to make sure that this time the rights are worth the paper they're written on.
All right. Tom, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Devine is the legal director of the Government Accountability Project. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Lita Martinez and Ariel Stuhlberg, who both finished their internships this week. Thank you both very, very much for your help. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.